a glossy black coffee table on which were scattered games and controllers, and low leather couches. A set of glass stairs led upward in a spiral. After a glance around, Clary began to climb them. The glass was perfectly clear and lent the impression that she was climbing an invisible staircase into the sky. The second floor was much like the first. Pale walls, black floor, a long corridor with doors opening off it. The first door led into what was clearly a master bedroom. A huge rosewood bed, hung with gauzy white curtains, took up most of the space. There were windows in here, tinted a dark blue. Clary went across the room to look out. She wondered for a moment if she was back in Alicante. She was looking across a canal at another building, its windows covered in closed green shutters. The sky above was gray, the canal a dark greenish blue, and there was a bridge visible just at her right, crossing the canal. Two people were standing on the bridge. One of them held a camera to his face and was industriously taking photos. Not Alicante, then. Amsterdam? Venice? She looked everywhere for a way to open the window, but there didn't appear to be one. She banged on the glass and shouted, but the bridge crossers took no notice. After a few moments, they moved on. Clary turned back into the bedroom and went to one of the wardrobes and threw it open. Her heart skipped a beat. The wardrobe was full of clothes, women's clothes, gorgeous dresses, lace and satin and beads and flowers. The drawers held camisoles and underwear, tops in cotton and silk, skirts but no jeans or pants. There were even shoes lined up, sandals and heels, and folded pairs of stockings. For a moment she just stared, wondering if there were another girl staying here, or if Sebastian had taken to cross-dressing. But the clothes all had the tags on them, and all of them were near her size. Not only that, she realized slowly, staring, they were exactly the shapes and colors that would suit her. Blues and greens and yellows, cut for a petite frame. Eventually, she drew out one of the simpler tops, a dark green cap-sleeved blouse with silk lacing up the front. After discarding her worn top on the floor, she shrugged the blouse on and glanced at the mirror hanging inside the wardrobe. It fit perfectly, made the most of her small figure, clinging to her waist, darkening the green of her eyes. She yanked the tag off, not wanting to see how much it had cost, and hurried out of the room, feeling a shiver run down her spine. The next room was clearly Jace's. She knew it the minute she walked in. It smelled like him, like the cologne and soap and the scent of his skin. The bed was ebonized wood with white sheets and blankets, perfectly made. It was as neat as his room at the Institute. Books were stacked by his bed, the titles in Italian and French and Latin. The silver Herondale dagger with its pattern of birds was jammed into the plaster wall. When she looked closer, she could see that it was pinning a photograph in place, a photograph of herself and Jace, taken by Izzy. She remembered it. A clear day in early October. Jace, sitting on the front steps of the Institute, a book on his lap. She was sitting a step above him, her hand on his shoulder, leaning forward to see what he was reading. His hand covered hers, almost absently, and he was smiling. She hadn't been able to see his face that day, hadn't known he was smiling like that, not until now. Her throat contracted, and she went out of the room, catching her breath. She couldn't act like this, she told herself sternly, as if each sight of Jace the way he was now was a sucker punch to the gut. She had to pretend that it didn't matter, as if she noticed no difference. She went into the next room, another bedroom, much like the one before it, but this one was a mess, the bed a tangle of black silk sheets and comforter, a glass and steel desk covered with books and papers, boy clothes scattered everywhere, jeans and jackets and t-shirts and gear. Her eye fell on something that gleamed silver, propped on the nightstand near the bed. She moved forward, staring, unable to believe her eyes. It was the small box of her mother's, the one with the initials J.C. on it. the one her mother used to take out every year, once a year, and weep over silently, the tears running down her face to splash onto her hands. Clary knew what was in the box. A lock of hair, as fine and white as dandelion fluff. Scraps from a child's shirt, a baby shoe, small enough to fit inside the palm of her hand. Bits and pieces of her brother, a sort of collage of the child her mother had wanted to have, had dreamed of having, before Valentine had done what he had and turned his own son into a monster. J.C. Jonathan Christopher. Her stomach twisted, and she backed up quickly out of the room, directly into a wall of living flesh. Arms came around her, wrapping her tight, and she saw that they were slim and muscular, downed with fine pale hair, and for a moment she thought it was Jace holding her. She began to relax.
"What were you doing in my room?"
Sebastian said into her ear. Isabel had been trained to wake up early every morning, rain or shine, and a slight hangover did nothing to prevent it from happening again. She sat up slowly and blinked down at Simon. She'd never spent an entire night in a bed with anyone else, unless you counted crawling into her parents' bed when she was 4 and afraid of thunderstorms. She couldn't help staring at Simon as if he were some exotic species of animal. He lay on his back, his mouth slightly open, his hair and his eyes. Ordinary brown hair, ordinary brown eyes. His t-shirt was pulled up slightly. He wasn't muscular like a shadow hunter. He had a smooth, flat stomach, but no six-pack, and there was still a hint of softness to his face. What was it about him that fascinated her? He was plenty cute, but she had dated gorgeous fairy knights, sexy shadow hunters.
"Isabel,"
Simon said without opening his eyes,
"quit staring at me."
Isabel sighed irritably and swung herself out of bed. She rummaged in her bag for her gear, retrieved it, and headed out to find the bathroom. It was halfway down the hall, and the door was just opening, Alec emerging in a cloud of steam. He had a towel around his waist and another around his shoulders, and was rubbing energetically at his wet black hair. Isabel supposed she shouldn't be surprised to see him. He'd been trained to wake up early in the morning just like she had.
"You smell like sandalwood," she said by way of greeting.
She hated the smell of sandalwood. She liked sweet scents. Vanilla, cinnamon, gardenia. Alec looked at her.
"We like sandalwood."
Isabel made a face.
"Either that's the royal we, or you and Magnus are turning into one of those couples that think they're one person. We like sandalwood. We adore the symphony. We hope you enjoy our Christmas present, which, if you ask me, is just a cheap way of avoiding having to buy 2 gifts.
Alec blinked wet lashes at her.
"You'll understand. If you tell me I'll understand when I'm in love, I'll smother you with that towel.
And if you keep preventing me from going back to my room and getting dressed, I'll get Magnus to summon up pixies to tie your hair in knots."
"Oh, get out of my way."
Isabel kicked at Alec's ankle until he moved, unhurriedly, down the hall. She had the feeling if she turned around and looked at him, he'd be sticking his tongue out at her, so she didn't look. Instead, she locked herself in the bathroom and turned on the shower full steam. Then she looked at the rack of shower products and said an unladylike word. "Sandalwood shampoo, conditioner, and soap."
Ugh.
When she finally emerged, dressed in her gear and with her hair up, she found Alec, Magnus, and Jocelyn waiting for her in the living room. There were donuts, which she didn't want, and coffee, which she did. She poured a liberal amount of milk into it and sat back, looking at Jocelyn, who was also dressed, to Isabel's surprise, in Shadow Hunter gear.
"It was odd," she mused. People often told her she looked like her mother, though she didn't see it herself,
and she wondered now if it was in the same way that Clary looked like Jocelyn. The same color hair, yes, but also the same cast of features. The same tilt of the head, the same stubborn set to the jaw. The same sense that this person might look like a porcelain doll, but was steel underneath.
Although, Isabel wished that, in the same way that Clary had gotten her mother's green eyes, she'd gotten Maris and Robert's blue ones. Blue was so much more interesting than black. As with the Silent City, there is only one adamant citadel. But there are many doors through which one may find it, said Magnus. The closest to us is the old Augustinian monastery on Grimes Hill in Staten Island. Alec and I will portal with you there and wait for you to return, but we can't go with you all the way. I know, said Isabel, because you're boys. Cooties. Alec pointed a finger at her. Take this seriously, Isabel. The Iron Sisters aren't like the Silent Brothers. They're way less friendly, and they don't like being bothered. I promise I'll be on my best behavior, Isabel said, and set her empty coffee mug down on the table. Let's go. Magnus looked at her suspiciously for a moment, then shrugged. His hair was gelled up today into a million sharp points, and his eyes were smudged with black, making them look more cat-like than ever. He moved past her to the wall, already murmuring in Latin, the familiar outline of a portal, its arcane door shaped outlined with glittering symbols, began to take form. Wind rose, cool and sharp, blowing back the tendrils of Isabel's hair. Jocelyn stepped forward first and walked through the portal. It was a little like watching someone disappear into the side of a wave of water. A silvery haze seemed to swallow her in, dulling the color of her red hair as she vanished into it with a faint shimmer. Isabel went next. She was used to the stomach-dropping feeling of transportation by portal. There was a soundless roar in her ears and no air in her lungs. She closed her eyes, then opened them again as the whirlwind released her and she fell into dry brush. She rose to her feet, brushing dead grass from her knees, and saw Jocelyn looking at her. Clary's mother opened her mouth and closed it again as Alec appeared, dropping into the vegetation beside Isabel, and then Magnus, the shimmering half-seen portal closing behind him. Even the trip through the portal had not disarranged Magnus's hair spikes. He tugged on one proudly. Check it out, he said to Isabel. Magic? Hair gel, $3.99 at Ricky's. Isabel rolled her eyes at him and turned to take in her new surroundings. They stood atop a hill, its peak covered in dry brush and withered grass. Lower down were autumn-blackened trees, and in the far distance, Isabel saw cloudless sky and the top of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge connecting Staten Island to Brooklyn. As she turned, Isabel saw the monastery behind her, rising out of the dull foliage. It was a large building of red brick, most of its windows smashed out or boarded over. It was tagged here and there with graffiti. Turkey vultures, disturbed by the traveler's arrival, circled the dilapidated bell tower. Isabel squinted at it, wondering if there was a glamour to be peeled off. If so, it was a strong one. Try as she might, she couldn't see anything but the ruinous building before her. There's no glamour, said Jocelyn, startling Isabel. What you see is what you get. Jocelyn trudged toward it, her boots crushing down the dry vegetation in front of her. After a moment, Magnus shrugged and followed her, and Isabel and Alec came after. There was no path. Branches grew in tangles, dark against the clear air, and the foliage underfoot crackled with dryness. As they neared the building, Isabel saw that patches of the dry grass were burned away where pentagrams and runic circles had been spray-painted into the grass. Mundanes, said Magnus, lifting a branch out of Isabel's way. Playing their little games with magic, not really understanding it. They're often drawn to places like this, centers of power, without really knowing why. They drink and hang out and spray-paint the walls, like you could leave a human mark on magic. You can't. They had reached a boarded-up door in the brick wall. We're here. Isabel looked hard at the door. Again, there was no sense that a glamour covered it, although if she concentrated hard, a faint shimmer grew visible, like sunshine glancing off water. A look passed between Jocelyn and Magnus. Jocelyn turned to Isabel. You're ready? Isabel nodded, And without further ado, Jocelyn stepped forward and vanished through the boards of the door. Magnus looked expectantly at Isabel. Alec leaned closer to her, and she felt the brush of his hand on her shoulder.
"Don't worry," he said. "You'll be fine, Iz."
She raised her chin.
"I know," she said,
and followed Jocelyn through the door.
Clary sucked in her breath. But before she could reply, there was a step on the stairs, and Jace appeared at the end of the hallway. Sebastian immediately let her go and spun her around. With a smile like a wolf's, he ruffled her hair.
"Good to see you, little sister."
Clary was speechless.
Jace, though, wasn't. He moved toward them soundlessly. He was wearing a black leather jacket, a white t-shirt and jeans, and was barefoot.
"Were you hugging Clary?"
He looked at Sebastian in amazement.
Sebastian shrugged. "She's my sister. I'm pleased to see her."
"You don't hug people," Jay said.
"I ran out of time to bake a casserole."
"It was nothing," Clary said, waving a dismissive hand at her brother.
"I tripped. He was just keeping me from falling over."
If Sebastian was surprised to hear her defend him, he didn't show it. He was expressionless as she moved across the corridor towards Jace, who kissed her on the cheek, his fingers cool against her skin.
"What were you doing up here?" Jace asked.
"Looking for you," she shrugged.
"I woke up and couldn't find you. I thought maybe you were asleep."
"I see you discovered the clothes, Sash." Sebastian indicated her shirt with a gesture. "Do you like them?"
Jace shot him a look.
"We were out getting food," he said to Clary.
"Nothing fancy. Bread and cheese.
You want lunch?"
Which was how, several minutes later, Clary found herself installed at the big glass and steel table. From the comestibles spread out over the table, she figured that her second guess had been right. They were in Venice. There was bread, Italian cheeses, salami and prosciutto, grapes and fig jam, and bottles of Italian wine. Jay sat across from her, Sebastian at the head of the table. She was eerily reminded of the night she had met Valentine at Renwick's in New York. How he had put himself between Jace and Clary at the head of the table. How he had offered them wine and told them they were brother and sister. She sneaked a glance at her real brother now. She thought of how her mother had looked when she'd seen him. Valentine. But Sebastian wasn't a carbon copy of their father. She had seen pictures of Valentine when he was their age. Sebastian's face tempered her father's hard features with her mother's prettiness. He was tall, but less broad-shouldered, more lithe and cat-like. He had Jocelyn's cheekbones and fine, soft mouth, Valentine's dark eyes and white blonde hair. He looked up then, as if he'd caught her staring at him.
"Wine?"
He offered the bottle. She nodded, though she had never much liked the taste of wine, and since Renwick's, she had hated it. She cleared her throat as Sebastian filled the glass.
"So," she said, "this place, is it yours?"
"It was our father's," said Sebastian, setting the bottle down.
"Valentine's. It moves in and out of worlds, ours and others. He used to use it as a retreat, as well as a mode of travel. He brought me here a few times, showed me how to get in and out, and how to make it travel."
"There's no front door."
"There is if you know how to find it," said Sebastian. "Dad was very clever about this place."
Clary looked at Jace, who shook his head. "He never showed it to me. I wouldn't have guessed it existed either."
"It's very bachelor pad," Clary said. "I wouldn't have thought of Valentine as..."
"Owning a flat-screen TV?" Jace grinned at her.
"Not that it gets channels, but you can watch DVDs on it. Back at the manor, we had an old icebox powered by witchlight. Here he's got a sub-zero fridge."
"That was for Jocelyn," said Sebastian. Clary looked up.
"What?" "All the modern stuff, the appliances, and the clothes. Like that shirt you're wearing, they were for our mother, in case she decided to come back."
Sebastian's dark eyes met hers. She felt a little sick.
This is my brother, and we're talking about our parents.
She felt dizzy. Too much happening too fast to take in, to process. She had never had time to think about Sebastian as her living, breathing brother. By the time she'd found out who he really was, he'd been dead.
Sorry if it's weird, Jay said apologetically, indicating her shirt. We can buy you some other clothes.
Clary touched the sleeve lightly. The fabric was silky, fine, expensive.
Well, that explained that. Everything close to her size. Everything in colors that suited her.
Because she looked just like her mother. She took a deep breath.
It's fine, she said. It's just... What do you do exactly? Just travel around inside this apartment and...
See the world? Jay said lightly.
There's worse things.
But you can't do that forever.
Sebastian hadn't eaten much, but he'd drunk 2 glasses of wine. He was on his third, and his eyes were glittering.
Why not?
Well, because. Because DeClave is looking for both of you, and you can't spend forever running and hiding.
Clary's voice trailed off as she looked from one of them to the other. They were sharing a look. The look of two people who knew something, together, that no one else did. It was not a look Jace had shared with someone else in front of her in a very long time.
Sebastian spoke softly and slowly. Are you asking a question or making an observation?
She has a right to know our plans, Jace said. She came here knowing she couldn't go back.
A leap of faith, said Sebastian, running his finger around the rim of his glass.
It was something Clary had seen Valentine do.
In you. She loves you. That's why she's here, isn't it?
So what if it is? Clary said. She supposed she could pretend there was another reason, but Sebastian's eyes were dark and sharp, and she doubted he'd believe her.
I trust Jace.
But not me, Sebastian said. Clary chose her next words with extreme care.
If Jace trusts you, then I want to trust you, she said.
And you're my brother. That counts for something. The lie tasted bitter in her mouth. But I don't really know you.
Then maybe you should spend a little time getting to know me, Sebastian said. And then we'll tell you our plans.
We'll tell you. Our plans. In his mind, there was a him and Jace. There was no Jace and Clary.
I don't like keeping her in the dark, Jace said.
We'll tell her in a week. What difference does a week make?
Jace gave him a look.
2 weeks ago, you were dead.
Well, I wasn't suggesting 2 weeks, said Sebastian. That would be insane.
Jace's mouth quirked up at the corner. He looked at Clary.
I'm willing to wait for you to trust me, she said. Knowing it was the right, smart thing to say, hating to say it, however long it takes.
A week, Jace said.
A week, agreed Sebastian. And that means she stays here in the apartment, no communication with anyone, no unlocking the door for her, no going in and out.
Jace leaned back.
What if I'm with her?
Sebastian gave him a long look from under lowered eyelashes. His look was calculating. He was deciding what he was going to allow Jace to do, Clary realized. He was deciding how much leash to give his brother.
Fine, he said at last, his voice rich with condescension. If you're with her.
Clary looked down at her wine glass. She heard Jace reply in a murmur but couldn't look at him.
The idea of a Jace who was allowed to do things. Jace. Who always did whatever he wanted, made her sick to her stomach. She wanted to get up and smash the wine bottle over Sebastian's head, but she knew it was impossible. Cut one and the other bleeds.
How's the wine? It was Sebastian's voice, an undercurrent of amusement playing in his tone. She drained the glass, choking on the bitter flavor.
Delicious. Isabel emerged in an alien landscape. A deep green plain swept out before her under a lowering gray-black sky. Isabel pulled up the hood of her gear and peered out, fascinated. She had never seen such a great, overarching expanse of sky, or such a vast plain. It was shimmering, jewel-toned, the shade of moss. As Isabel took a step forward, she realized it was moss, growing on and around the black rocks scattered across the coal-colored earth. "It's a volcanic plain," Jocelyn said. She was standing beside Isabel, and the wind was pulling red-gold strands of her hair out of its tightly pinned bun. She looked so much like Clary that it was eerie. "These were lava beds once. The whole area is probably volcanic to some degree. Working with Atomos, the sisters need incredible heat for their forges." "You'd think it would be a little warmer then," Isabel muttered. Jocelyn cast her a dry look and started walking, in what seemed to Isabel a randomly chosen direction. She scrambled to follow. "Sometimes you're so much like your mother, you astound me a little, Isabel." "I take that as a compliment." Isabel narrowed her eyes. No one insulted her family. It wasn't meant as an insult. Isabel kept her eyes on the horizon, where the dark sky met the jewel-green ground. "How well did you know my parents?" Jocelyn gave her a quick sideways look. "Well enough. When we were all in Idris together. I hadn't seen them for years until recently." "Did you know them when they got married?" The path Jocelyn was taking had begun to slant uphill, so her reply was slightly breathless. "Yes." "Were they in love?" Jocelyn stopped short and turned to look at Isabel. "Isabel, what is this about?" "Love?" Isabel suggested after a moment's pause. "I don't know why you think I'd be the expert on that. Well, you managed to keep Luke hanging around for his whole life, basically, before you agreed to marry him. That's impressive. I wish I had that kind of power over a guy." "You do," said Jocelyn. "Have it, I mean. And it isn't something to wish for." She pushed her hands up through her hair, and Isabel felt a little jolt. For all that Jocelyn looked like her daughter, her thin, long hands, flexible and delicate, were Sebastian's. Isabel remembered slicing one of those hands off in the valley in Idris, her whip cutting through skin and bone. "Your parents aren't perfect, Isabel, because no one's perfect. They're complicated people, and they just lost a child. So if this is about your father staying in Idris..." "My father cheated on my mother," Isabel blurted out, and nearly covered her own mouth with her hand. She had kept the secret, kept it for years, and to say it out loud to Jocelyn seemed like a betrayal, despite everything. Jocelyn's face changed. It held sympathy now. "I know." Isabel took a sharp breath. "Does everyone know?" Jocelyn shook her head. "No, a few people. I was in a privileged position to know. I can't say more than that." "Who was it?" Isabel demanded. "Who did he cheat on her with?" "It was no one you know, Isabel." "You don't know who I know?" Isabel's voice rose. "And stop saying my name that way, as if I'm a little kid." "It's not my place to tell you," Jocelyn said flatly, and began to walk again. Isabel scrambled after her. Even as the path took a steeper turn upward, a wall of green rising to meet the thunderous sky. "I have every right to know. They're my parents, and if you don't tell me, I..." She stopped, inhaling sharply. They had reached the top of the ridge, and somehow, in front of them, a fortress had sprung like a fast-blooming flower out of the ground. It was carved of white-silver Atomos, reflecting the cloud-streaked sky. Towers topped with electrum reached toward the sky, and the fortress was surrounded by a high wall, also of Atomos, in which was set a single gate, formed of two great blades plunged into the ground at angles, so that they resembled a monstrous pair of scissors. "The Adamant Citadel," said Jocelyn. "Thanks," Isabel snapped. "I figured that out." Jocelyn made the noise that Isabel was familiar with from her own parents. Isabel was pretty sure it was parent speak for teenagers. Then Jocelyn started down the hill to the fortress. Isabel, tired of scrambling, stalked ahead of her. She was taller than Clary's mother and had longer legs, and saw no reason why she should wait for Jocelyn if the other woman was going to persist in treating her like a child. She stomped down the hill, crushing moss under her boots, ducked through the scissor-like gates, and froze. She was standing on a small outcropping of rock. In front of her, the earth dropped away into a vast chasm, at the bottom of which boiled a river of red-gold lava encircling the fortress. Across the chasm, much too far to jump, even for a shadow hunter, was the only visible entrance to the fortress, a closed drawbridge. "Some things," said Jocelyn at her elbow, "are not as simple as they first appear." Isabel jumped, then glared. "So not the place to sneak up on someone." Jocelyn simply crossed her arms over her chest and raised her eyebrows. "Surely Hodge taught you the proper method of approaching the Adamant Citadel," she said. "After all, it is open to all female shadow hunters in good standing with the Clave." "Of course he did," said Isabel haughtily, scrambling mentally to remember. "Only those with Nephilim blood." She reached up and took one of the metal chopsticks from her hair. When she twisted its base, it popped and clicked and unfolded into a dagger with a rune of courage on the blade. Isabel raised her hand over the chasm. "Ignis aurum probat," she said, and used the dagger to cut open her left palm. It was a swift, searing pain, and blood ran from the cut, a ruby stream that splattered into the chasm below. There was a flash of blue light and a creaking noise. The drawbridge was slowly lowering. Isabel smiled and wiped the blade of her knife on her gear. After another twist, it had become a slim metal chopstick again. She slid it back into her hair. "Do you know what that means?" asked Jocelyn, her eyes on the lowering bridge. "What?" "What you just said. The motto of the Iron Sisters." The drawbridge was almost flat. "It means fire tests gold." "Right," said Jocelyn. "They don't just mean forges and metalwork. They mean that adversity tests one's strength of character. In difficult times, in dark times, some people shine." "Oh, yeah?" said Izzy. "Well, I'm sick of dark and difficult times. Maybe I don't want to shine." The drawbridge crashed at their feet. "If you're anything like your mother," said Jocelyn, "you won't be able to help it." Chapter 9. The Iron Sisters. Alec raised the witchlight runestone high in his hand, brilliant light raying out from it, spotlighting now one corner of the City Hall station and then another. He jumped as a mouse squeaked, running across the dusty platform. He was a shadow hunter. He had been in many dark places. But there was something about the abandoned air of this station that made a cold shiver run up his spine. Perhaps it was the chill of disloyalty he had felt, slipping away from his guard post on Staten Island and heading down the hill to the ferry the moment Magnus had left. He hadn't thought about what he was doing. He'd just done it, as if he were an autopilot. If he hurried, he was sure he could be back before Isabel and Jocelyn returned, before anyone realized he'd ever been gone. Alec raised his voice. "Camille!" he called. "Camille Belcour!" He heard a light laugh. It echoed off the walls of the station. Then she was there, at the top of the stairs, the brilliance of her witchlight rendering her a silhouette. "Alexander Lightwood," she said. "Come upstairs." She vanished. Alec followed his darting witchlight up the steps and found Camille where he had before, in the lobby of the station. She was dressed in the fashion of a bygone era, a long velvet dress nipped in at the waist, her hair dressed high in white blonde curls, her lips dark red. He supposed she was beautiful, though he wasn't the best judge of feminine appeal. And it didn't help that he hated her. "What's with the costume?" he demanded. She smiled.
Her skin was very smooth and white, without dark lines. She had fed recently.
"A masquerade ball downtown. I fed quite well. Why are you here, Alexander? Starved for good conversation?"
If he were Jace, Alec thought, he'd have a smart remark for that. Some kind of pun or cleverly disguised put-down. Alec just bit his lip and said,
"You told me to come back if I was interested in what you were offering."
She ran a hand along the back of the divan, the only piece of furniture in the room.
"And you've decided that you are."
Alec nodded. She chuckled.
"You understand what you are asking for."
Alec's heart was pounding. He wondered if Camille could hear it.
"You said you could make Magnus mortal, like me."
Her full lips thinned.
"I did," she said. "I must admit, I doubted your interest. You left rather hastily."
"Don't play with me," he said. "I don't want what you're offering that badly."
"Liar," she said casually, "or you wouldn't be here."
She moved around the divan, coming close to him, her eyes raking his face.
"Up close," she said. "You do not look so much like Will as I had thought. You have his coloring, but a different shape to your face. Perhaps a slight weakness to your jaw."
"Shut up," he said. "Okay, it wasn't Jace-level wit, but it was something. I don't want to hear about Will."
"Very well," she stretched like a cat. "It was many years ago when Magnus and I were lovers. We were in bed together after quite a passionate evening."
She saw him flinch and grinned.
"You know how it is with pillow talk. One reveals one's weaknesses. Magnus spoke to me of a spell that existed, one that might be undertaken to rid a warlock of their immortality."
"So why don't I just find out what the spell is and do it?" Alec's voice rose and cracked. "Why do I need you?"
"First, because you're a shadow hunter. You've no idea how to work a spell," she said calmly. "Second, because if you do it, he'll know it was you. If I do it, he will assume it is revenge. Spite on my part, and I do not care what Magnus thinks. But you do."
Alec looked at her steadily.
"And you're going to do this for me as a favor?"
She laughed, like tinkling bells.
"Of course not," she said. "You do a favor for me, and I will do one for you. That is how these matters are conducted."
Alec's hand tightened around the witchlight runestone until the edges cut into his hand.
"And what favor do you want from me?"
"It's very simple," she said. "I want you to kill Raphael Santiago."
The bridge that crossed the crevice surrounding the adamant citadel was lined with knives. They were sunk, point upward, at random intervals along the path, so that it was possible to cross the bridge only very slowly, by picking your way with dexterity. Isabel had little trouble, but was surprised to see how lightly Jocelyn, who hadn't been an active shadow hunter in 15 years, made her way. By the time Isabel had reached the opposite side of the bridge, her dexteratus rune had vanished into her skin, leaving a faint white mark behind. Jocelyn was only a step behind her, and as aggravating as Isabel found Clary's mother, she was glad in a moment when Jocelyn raised her hand and a witchlight runestone blazed forth, illuminating the space they stood in. The walls were hewn from white silver adamas, so that the dim light seemed to glow from within them. The floor was demon stone as well, and carved into the center of it was a black circle. Inside the circle, the symbol of the Iron Sisters was carved, a heart punctured through and through by a blade. Whispering voices made Isabel tear her gaze from the floor and look up. A shadow had appeared inside one of the smooth white walls, a shadow growing ever clearer, ever closer. Suddenly, a portion of the wall slid back and a woman stepped out. She wore a long, loose white gown, bound tightly at the wrists and under her breasts with silver-white cord, demon wire. Her face was both unwrinkled and ancient. She could have been any age. Her hair was long and dark, hanging in a thick braid down her back. Across her eyes and temples was an intricately curly-cued tattooed mask encircling both her eyes, which were the orange color of leaping flames.
"Who calls on the Iron Sisters?" she said. "Speak your names."
Isabel looked toward Jocelyn, who gestured that she should speak first. She cleared her throat.
"I am Isabel Lightwood, and this is Jocelyn Fairchild. We have come to ask your help."
"Jocelyn Morgenstern," said the woman. "Born Fairchild, but you cannot so easily erase the taint of Valentine from your past. Have you not turned your back on the Clave?"
"It is true," said Jocelyn. "I am an outcast. But Isabel is a daughter of the Clave. Her mother..."
"Runs the New York Institute," said the woman. "We are remote here, but not without sources of information. I am no fool. My name is Sister Cleophas, and I am a maker. I shape the Adamus for the other sisters to carve. I recognize that whip you wind so cunningly around your wrist," she indicated Isabel. "As for that bauble around your throat..."
"If you know so much," said Jocelyn, as Isabel's hand crept to the ruby at her neck, "then do you know why we are here? Why we have come to you?"
Sister Cleophas's eyelids lowered, and she smiled slowly.
"Unlike our speechless brethren, we cannot read minds here in the fortress. Therefore, we rely upon a network of information, most of it very reliable. I assume this visit has something to do with the situation involving Jace Lightwood, as his sister is here, and your son, Jonathan Morgenstern."
"We have a conundrum," said Jocelyn. "Jonathan Morgenstern plots against the Clave, like his father. The Clave has issued a death warrant against him. But Jace, Jonathan Lightwood, is very much loved by his family, who have done no wrong, and by my daughter. The conundrum is that Jace and Jonathan are bound by very ancient blood magic."
"Blood magic? What sort of blood magic?"
Jocelyn took Magnus's folded notes from the pocket of her gear and handed them over. Cleophas studied them with her intent, fiery gaze. Isabel saw with a start that the fingers of her hands were very long, not elegantly long, but grotesquely so, as if the bones had been stretched so that each hand resembled an albino spider. Her nails were filed to points, each tipped with electrum. She shook her head.
"The sisters have little to do with blood magic."
The flame color of her eyes seemed to leap and then dim, and a moment later another shadow appeared behind the frosted glass surface of the Adamus wall. This time, Isabel watched more closely as a second Iron Sister stepped through. It was like watching someone emerge from a haze of white smoke.
"Sister Dolores," said Cleophas, handing Magnus's note to the new arrival.
She looked much like Cleophas. The same tall, narrow form, the same white dress, the same long hair, though in this case her hair was gray, and bound at the ends of her two braids with gold wire. Despite her gray hair, her face was lineless, her fire-colored eyes bright.
"Can you make sense of this?"
Dolores glanced over the pages briefly.
"A twinning spell," she said. "Much like our own parabatai ceremony, but its alliance is demonic."
"What makes it demonic?" Isabel demanded. "If the spell is harmless..."
"Is it?" said Cleophas,
but Dolores shot her a quelling look. "The parabatai ritual binds two individuals, but leaves their wills free," Dolores explained. "This binds two, but makes one subordinate to the other. What the primary of the two believes, the other will believe. What the first one wants, the second will want. It essentially removes the free will of the secondary partner in the spell. And that is why it is demonic. For free will is what makes us heaven's creatures.
It also seems to mean that when one is wounded, the other is wounded, said Jocelyn.
Might we presume the same about death?
Yes. Neither will survive the death of the other. This, again, is not part of our Parabatai ritual, for it is too cruel.
Our question to you is this, said Jocelyn. Is there any weapon forged, or that you might create, that could harm one but not the other, or that might cut them apart?
Sister Dolores looked down at the notes, then handed them to Jocelyn. Her hands, like those of her colleague, were long and thin and as white as floss.
No weapon we have forged or could ever forge might do that.
Isabel's hand tightened at her side, her nails cutting into her palm.
You mean there's nothing?
Nothing in this world, said Dolores.
A blade of heaven or hell might do it.
The sword of the Archangel Michael, that Joshua fought with at Jericho, for it is infused with heavenly fire, and there are blades forged in the blackness of the pit that might aid you. Though how one might be obtained, I do not know.
And we would be prevented from telling you by the law if we did know, said Cleophas with asperity.
You understand, of course, that we will also have to tell the Clave about this visit of yours.
What about Joshua's sword? Interrupted Isabel. Can you get that? Or can we?
Only an angel can gift you that sword, said Dolores. And to summon an angel is to be blasted with heavenly fire.
But Raziel, Isabel began.
Cleophas's lips thinned into a straight line.
Raziel left us the mortal instruments that he might be called upon in a time of direst need. That one chance was wasted when Valentine summoned him. We shall never be able to compel his might again. It was a crime to use the instruments in that manner. The only reason that Clarissa Morganston escaped culpability is that it was her father who summoned him, not herself.
My husband also summoned another angel, said Jocelyn. Her voice was quiet. The angel Ethereal. He kept him imprisoned for many years.
Both sisters hesitated before Dolores spoke.
It is the bleakest of crimes to entrap an angel, she said. The Clave could never approve it. Even if you could summon one, you could never force it to do your bidding. There is no spell for that. You could never get an angel to give you the Archangel's sword. You can take by force from an angel, but there is no greater crime. Better that your Jonathan die than an angel be so besmirched.
At that, Isabel, whose temper had been rising, exploded.
That's the problem with you, all of you, the Iron Sisters and the Silent Brothers. Whatever they do to change you from Shadowhunters to what you are, it takes all of the feelings out of you. We might be part angel, but we're part human too. You don't understand love, or the things people do for love, or family.
The flames leaped in Dolores' orange eyes.
I had a family, she said. A husband and children, all murdered by demons. There was nothing left to me. I had always had a skill with shaping things with my hands, so I became an Iron Sister. The peace it has brought me is peace I think I would never have found elsewhere. It is for that reason I chose the name Dolores, Sorrow. So do not presume to tell us what we do or do not know about pain or humanity.
You don't know anything, Isabel snapped. You're as hard as demon stone. No wonder you surround yourselves with it.
Fire tempers gold, Isabel Lightwood, said Cleophas.
Oh, shut up, Isabel said.
You've been very unhelpful, both of you.
She turned on the heel of her boot, spun away, and stalked back across the bridge, barely taking note of where the knives turned the path into a death trap, letting her body's training guide her. She reached the other side and strode through the gates. Only when she was outside them did she break down. Kneeling among the moss and volcanic rocks, Under the great gray sky, she let herself shake silently, though no tears came. It seemed ages before she heard a soft step beside her, and Jocelyn knelt and put her arms around her. Oddly, Isabel found that she didn't mind. Though she had never much liked Jocelyn, there was something so universally motherly in her touch that Isabel leaned into it, almost against her own will. "Do you want to know what they said after you left?" Jocelyn asked, after Isabel's trembling had slowed. "I'm sure something about how I'm a disgrace to shadow hunters everywhere, etc." "Actually, Cleophas said you'd make an excellent Iron Sister, and if you were ever interested, to let them know." Jocelyn's hand stroked her hair lightly. Despite everything, Isabel choked back a laugh. She looked up at Jocelyn. "Tell me," she said. Jocelyn's hand stopped moving. "Tell you what? Who it was that my father had the affair with? You don't understand. Every time I see a woman my mother's age, I wonder if it was her. Luke's sister, the consul, you." Jocelyn sighed. "It was Anna Marie Highsmith. She died in Valentine's attack on Alicante. I doubt you ever knew her." Isabel's mouth opened, then closed again. "I've never even heard her name before." "Good." Jocelyn tucked a lock of Isabel's hair back. "Do you feel any better, now that you know?" "Sure," Isabel lied, staring down at the ground. "I feel a lot better." After lunch, Clary had returned to the downstairs bedroom with the excuse that she was exhausted. With the door firmly closed, she had tried contacting Simon again, though she realized, given the time difference between where she was now, Italy, and New York, there was every chance he was asleep. At least she prayed he was asleep. It was far preferable to hope for that than to consider the possibility that the rings might not work. She had been in the bedroom for only about half an hour when a knock sounded at the door. She called, "Come in." Moving to lean back on her hands, her fingers curled in as if she could hide the ring. The door swung open slowly, and Jace looked down at her from the doorway. She remembered another night, summer heat, a knock on her door. Jace, clean, in jeans and a gray shirt, his washed hair a halo of damp gold. The bruises on his face were already fading from purple to faint gray, and his hands were behind his back. "Hey," he said. His hands were in plain sight now, and he was wearing a soft-looking sweater, the color of bronze, that brought out the gold in his eyes. There were no bruises on his face, and the shadows she had almost grown used to seeing under his eyes were gone. "Is he happy like this? Really happy? And if he is, what are you saving him from?" Clary pushed away the tiny voice in her head and forced a smile. "What's up?" He grinned. It was a wicked grin, the kind that made the blood in Clary's veins run a little faster. "You want to go on a date?" Caught off guard, she stammered. What? "A date," Jace repeated. "Often a boring thing you have to memorize in history class, but in this case, an offer of an evening of blisteringly white-hot romance with yours truly." "Really?" Clary was not sure what to make of this. "Blisteringly white-hot?" "It's me," said Jace. "Watching me play Scrabble is enough to make most women swoon. Imagine if I actually put in some effort." Clary sat up and looked down at herself. Jeans, silky green top. She thought about the cosmetics in that odd shrine-like bedroom. She couldn't help it. She was wishing for a little lip gloss. Jace held his hand out. "You look gorgeous," he said. "Let's go." She took his hand and let him pull her to her feet. "I don't know." "Come on." His voice had that self-mocking, seductive tone she remembered from when they had first been getting to know each other. when he'd brought her up to the greenhouse to show her the flower that bloomed at midnight.
"We're in Italy. Venice. One of the most beautiful cities in the world. Shame not to see it, don't you think?"
Jace pulled her forward, so she fell against his chest. The material of his shirt was soft under her fingers, and he smelled like his familiar soap and shampoo. Her heart took a sweeping dive inside her chest.
"Or we could stay in," he said, sounding a little breathless.
"So I can swoon watching you make a triple word score?" With an effort, she pulled back from him. "And spare me the jokes about scoring."
"Damn it, woman, you read my mind," he said.
"Is there no filthy wordplay you can't foresee?"
"It's my special magic power. I can read your mind when you're thinking dirty thoughts."
"So 95% of the time?" She craned her head back to look at him.
95%? What's the other 5%?
"Oh, you know, the usual. Demons I might kill, runes I might need to learn, people who've annoyed me recently, people who've annoyed me not so recently. Ducks."
"Ducks?"
He waved her question away. "All right, now watch this." He took her shoulders and turned her gently so they were both facing the same way. A moment later, she wasn't sure how, the walls of the room seemed to melt away around them, and she found herself stepping out onto cobblestones. She gasped, turning to look behind her, and saw only a blank wall. Windows high up in an old stone building. Rows of similar houses lined the canal they stood beside. If she craned her head to the left, she could see in the distance that the canal opened out into a much larger waterway, lined with grand buildings. Everywhere was the smell of water and stone.
"Cool, huh?" Jace said proudly.
She turned and looked at him. "Ducks?" she said again. A smile tugged the edge of his mouth. "I hate ducks. I don't know why. I just always have." It was early morning when Maya and Jordan arrived at the Preacher House, the headquarters of the Preacher Lupus. The truck clanked and bumped over the long white drive that swept through manicured lawns to a massive house that rose like the prow of a ship in the distance. Behind it, Maya could see strips of trees, and behind that, the blue water of the Sound some distance away.
"This is where you did your training?" she demanded.
"This place is gorgeous!"
"Don't be fooled," Jordan said with a smile. "This place is boot camp. Emphasis on the boot."
She looked sideways at him. He was still smiling. He had been, pretty much non-stop, since she'd kissed him down by the beach at dawn. Part of Maya felt as if a hand had lifted her up and dropped her back into her past, when she'd loved Jordan beyond anything she'd ever imagined, and part of her felt totally adrift, as if she'd woken up in a completely foreign landscape, far from the familiarity of her everyday life and the warmth of the pack. It was very peculiar. Not bad, she thought. Just peculiar. Jordan came to a stop at a circular drive in front of the house, which, up close, Maya could see was built of blocks of golden stone, the tawny color of a wolf pelt. Black double doors were set at the top of a massive stone staircase. In the center of the circular drive was a massive sundial, its raised face telling her that it was 7 in the morning. Around the edge of the sundial, words were carved. "I only mark the hours that shine." She unlocked her door and jumped down from the cab just as the doors of the house opened, and a voice rang out, "Preacher Kyle!" Jordan and Maya both looked up. Descending the stairs was a middle-aged man in a charcoal suit, his blonde hair streaked with gray. Jordan, smoothing all expression from his face, turned to him. "Preacher Scott," he said. "This is Maya Roberts, of the Garraway Pack."
"Maya, this is Preacher Scott. He runs the Preacher Lupus, pretty much."
"Since the 1800s, the Scots have always run the Preacher," said the man, glancing at Maya, who inclined her head, a sign of submission.
Jordan, I have to admit, we did not expect you back again so soon. The situation with the vampire in Manhattan, the Daylighter, is in hand.